Well, good evening. Thank you for being with us this evening as we continue our series of searching for different things. Tonight we're going to be thinking about this one, searching for healing. In just a moment or two on the screen, on the bottom there'll be a number inviting you to text in a question throughout any point of the evening. And once I've finished talking in about 20 minutes or so, we'll have a bit of time to interact over those questions. So Alec will be has my phone. It is my number if you need to get me at any other point in the week, it seems. And Alec will put your questions to me, and hopefully there'll be a few good ones that put me on the spot and get me squirming. Well, searching for healing is our topic this evening. Let's start with an interview with the television personality, the intellectual atheist Stephen Fry. He was interviewed a few years ago on Irish television. And as a well-known atheist, he was asked by the interviewer, "So what if you're wrong? What if you die and you arrive at the pearly gates and you meet the big man himself? What will you say?" Stephen Fry didn't hold back. Here's what he said. "How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world that is so full of injustice and pain?" You can go on to YouTube and watch it for yourself and see what else he said. But strong words from Stephen Fry. And yet he wasn't just speaking for himself. Stephen Fry was speaking for many people who have wrestled with this question. How could a good God allow so much hurting in this world? Where is he when everything seems to be going wrong? This question of suffering isn't just an academic one for ivory tower theologians, for armchair philosophers. The problem and the question of suffering is a deeply personal one for all of us. Because I'm quite sure that there is not a single person in this room this evening who does not know what it is like to taste the bitter realities of suffering in their life. This evening, we are hurting people in a hurting world, filled with people who are searching for healing. And this evening you're in a church, you're in a community of people who have many experiences of suffering. You think if you could name a type of suffering, I guarantee you there's someone here who has either personal experience of it or who knows someone who has experienced it. You're in a community of people who have experienced cuts and bruises, miscarriages and infertilities, broken bones and broken hearts, people with struggling minds and struggling emotions, people who know what it is like to have cancer, depression, to have self-harmed, to be plagued by anxieties. These and many more things mark us out as people in a church community. You know, what amazes me is that you're in a church of 400, 450 people, and their pain has not driven them from God. It's actually driven them closer to him. Stephen Fry and his experiences, his observations of the world, it seems to have driven him from God, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way, because you are surrounded by many people who have been driven closer to him. There's a thought for you this evening. Well, as we start looking at this question, how could a good God allow so much hurting? Let's start with just noticing something in our society, that today we are privileged, we are blessed to live in a time and a place where we are more insulated from the problems of suffering than any society before. We benefit from advances in wealth, in technology, in medicine. We are more insulated from the pains and hurts of life than our ancestors were. And yet there are many people who are noticing that even though our level of suffering is considerably less today, that as a society, we are struggling more with that lower level of suffering than our ancestors ever did before as well. We just don't seem to be able to cope with it. And people are starting to ask the question, why? Why is it that we are so troubled by the problems of pain and hurt? Well, part of the reason, I think, is that we live in what you might call a secular society. That is the air that we breathe. Secularism. Secularism is a worldview, it's a philosophy that says that all there is this here and now world. This here and now material world, that's all there is. There is nothing beyond it. There is nothing greater than it. That's just all there is. And if that's how you see things, then that means that suffering in this here and now material world, it has no higher purpose. It has no grand meaning. It's just a brutal, tragic fact of existence. It will frustrate your ability to achieve your dreams and fulfill happiness in your life. In essence, suffering is just a tragic waste of your precious short time in this life, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can try to minimize it, you can try to avoid it, but in the end, it's just the way things are. And yet, we don't seem to be able to cope with that. The idea that our suffering has no purpose. We're not happy with that answer. And it's interesting that our gut-felt reaction when we suffer tells us that there's something more to the nature of suffering than it's just a fact of nature, it's just the way things are. One Christian philosopher has observed that only we human beings spell pain, P-A-I-N, the way we do. And the point he's making is not about spelling. He's making the point about that when we complain about suffering, pain, hurting, evil, we are not complaining about facts of nature. We are complaining as if suffering is a moral problem. Think of it this way. We've had some really lovely weather in Scotland this last week. It's not been as great today. I'm told that the week ahead is not looking that great again either. But whenever we're going about our days in Scotland and it starts raining, as much as we might be like, oh, here we go again. When will the summer ever come? Or have we just had our 2 days of summer and it's over now for the rest of the year? But none of us begin to say, this is outrageous. This is evil. The rain is coming down again. It's wrong. It's evil. It's wicked. No one starts talking about the weather that way, even though it spoils our plans, wrecks our days. It's a frustration. However, when we experience pain and suffering in our lives, that's the kind of reaction we have. This is wrong. This should not be this way. This is wicked. We don't greet it like the weather, like a fact of nature. We greet it as if it's a moral problem. And secularism is unable to help us explain this intuitive, gut-felt response that we have to pain and evil in this world. An example of someone who takes secularism to its logical conclusion is Professor Richard Dawkins. He wrote in his book, River East of Eden, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. That's where secularism ultimately takes you. There's no good, there's no evil, it's just the way it is. Yeah, I guarantee you that whenever bad things happen in Richard Dawkins' life or in the life of his family, that he does not greet them with pitiless indifference, but rather he screams out that you and I do, this is wrong, this is not right, this is not the way things should be, this is not fair. Because even Richard Dawkins, just like you and me, understands that there is a sense in which we live in a moral universe with moral laws, moral standards that tell us there's a difference between good and a difference between evil. There's a right and there's a wrong. And here's the thing. You don't get moral laws like that without a moral lawgiver. Former skeptic C.S. Lewis, his world was turned upside down by that realization. He wrote a generation ago, my argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. And what Lewis is getting at there is he is saying that we only recognize that suffering is wrong, that it's out of place in our lives and in our world, because deep down we know it, God, that there is a good God who is inscribed upon our hearts, upon our conscience, his good moral standards, his good moral laws. And we know that as we go along life's path and journey, that our experiences don't match the way things were made to be. That what we experience is wrong, it's bad, it shouldn't be, it's not fair. The question is, why is the world like that? If there is a good God, a good moral lawgiver, he's planted those, he's inscribed those good moral things in our hearts, why is it the world that we live in is so not right? Every worldview, every philosophy, every religion has to face that question. The problem of suffering is not just a problem for Christianity, it's a problem for Islam, it's a problem for atheism, it's a problem for Hinduism, it's a problem for all the world religions, all the world philosophies. Everyone has to grapple with this reality and this problem. But this evening I want to suggest to you and share with you what I believe is the Christian answer, which I believe has the best resources to help us resolve our search for healing in the midst of a world of hurting. And ultimately, the Christian's answer is not a watertight argument. There are some arguments this evening, but the ultimate answer is not a watertight argument, but is a watertight person, Jesus Christ. Well, to get us in, I've got three things for us briefly this evening. The first thing is a reason for suffering. People are right to ask, if God is truly good, then how come the world that he has made has turned out so very badly wrong? People rightly wonder, where has evil come from? Let me tell you, the evil was not God's idea. The Bible tells us that when God made this world, when he made this universe, it was very good. There was not a hint of evil or wickedness or brokenness anywhere to be found. So then where does evil come from, if it's not God's idea, if it's not God's design? Well, evil is not a thing that God made. Evil is more like a cancer. Evil is more like a parasite that comes along later and that tries to suck the life out of the host. It's like a good cell that somehow goes wrong and turns into this cancer, this tumor that begins to suck away life and vitality and that brings about death. You and I live in a good world that has gone wrong. And there are two ways that things can go wrong. Things can go wrong because of user error or manufacturing error. Some of you might, when you're on your computers, might get little error things that come up these days, maybe fewer than there used to be whenever I was first starting out in the computer world. But here, I find this quite interesting on Google, this funny picture of user error. It's not our fault the computer complains. Don't hit me, don't shout at me, it's your fault you've done the wrong thing. To change the picture a little bit, here's my old phone. Up until 2.5 years ago, this is what I used. I used this phone for, I think, 8 years. It did me really well before I finally moved into smartphone world. But you also might notice that there is quite a big crack. Can you see it at the back, roughly? Do you see the bit of a crack there? Now, if I had gone to the O2 shop down in Cameron Toll near our house and said to them, look, what do you make of this? There's a crack in my phone screen. What are you going to do about it? I'm not satisfied. They might turn out and say, well, sir, we're very sorry about that. Can you tell us, when you opened the box, did it come out looking like that? To which I'd have to say, well, no, actually it didn't. And they'd say, well, sir, can you tell us, when did you first notice the crack in the screen? I'd have to tell them, well, it was one morning, early in the morning, I noticed that there was a crack in the screen. And they might then ask, well, sir, how did that happen? Do you have any idea how the crack could have got into the screen overnight? To which the answer was, my alarm went off, and I wasn't happy about it, and I made it go away. To which then the O2 people in the shop in Cameron Toll would be entirely right in saying, sir, it's not our fault. You did it. This is user error, not manufacturing error. We're not giving you any money back. And they'd be entirely right to say that. And I want to suggest to you that the world in which, the broken world, the hurting world in which we live, it is that way not because of manufacturing error on God's part. Unfortunately, it's down to user error, our part. Now, often people would ask me, well, okay, user error. But could God not have made a world in which it is impossible for user errors to happen at all? Couldn't God have made a world in which evil could never have arisen in the first place? To which I would have to say, maybe he could have. But let me suggest that you probably wouldn't want to live in a world like that. Because that would be a world of machines, a world of robots. You see, love always requires a free choice if it's to be real, if it's to be genuine, if it's to be meaningful. Love is not something that can be coerced. Here's an example. Our wee toddler Joel is getting more and more expressive. He's getting more and more words each week. And just 2 weeks ago, Joel was playing at home with us, and I said to Joel, Joel, do you love your mummy? Just that week, he had learned to say, well, to indicate yes up until this point. Everything's been no, no, no. But he had learned to do this, a very definite pronounced nod. When he wanted to say yes. Joel, do you love your mummy? Oh, even better. Reaches out, comes over to his mummy, reaches out his hands, gives her a hug and a kiss. A couple of times. Then I say, Joel, you know what's coming. Joel, do you love your daddy? No. Always that. Did it again this afternoon. Do you love your daddy? No. Love always requires a choice. Beautiful moment for Kirsty, for me, frustration. But in that moment, I could have gone and picked up Joel. I'm bigger than him. I'm stronger than him for now. I could have done terrible things to him. I could have tried to force him to nod his head and say, through tears, but it would mean nothing. And indeed, you'd be entitled to go and ring social services and get him taken off me for being a bad father. Love always requires a free choice if it is to be real and it is to be genuine. And so God gave us, and when he made this good world, freedom. He gave us the freedom to choose to live for him and to love him. But that very choice also requires the opposite possibility, that we would choose to reject him and live for ourselves. And unfortunately, the human race has chosen that second option, to reject God and to live for ourselves. And so let me suggest to you that this world is not the way it's meant to be. User error. Because the human race has chosen not to be what we were made to be. And that means that we are part of the problem of evil, the part of the problem of pain and suffering in this world that we demand God sorts out. And let me reassure you that the God of the universe is a God of justice, a God of goodness, a God who cares deeply about the pain that you have suffered in your life. He cares about the evil that has been inflicted upon you by other people. But also, God cares about the wrong things that each one of us have done against other people. He cares about the tears that we've caused others. He cares about the hurt of our words to others, the actions, our selfishness. God cares about those things as well. Each of us, in all of our big or small ways, contributes to all that is morally wrong in this world. We're part of the problem. And that's not easy for us to hear. We don't want to hear that. Let me tell you the story of someone who can talk from experience about the problem of evil in our own hearts. His name is Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I've been reading his three-volume work just in recent months. Solzhenitsyn was an officer in the Soviet Army in World War II who was caught writing letters to a friend from the front lines complaining about Stalin and his policies. So he was arrested. He was put through torture and horrendous things in prison. He then was exiled to the Gulag system in the desolate remote parts of Russia, where he was basically a slave laborer for years. Solzhenitsyn was a survivor where some 30 to 40 million, it's estimated, people died under the tyranny of Stalin's Gulag regime. And here's what Solzhenitsyn has to say about the problem of evil. He says, if only it were so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? See, evil is not just a problem out there in other people, Solzhenitsyn is saying. He's saying that evil is very much a part of each of our hearts. We're not just sufferers, but we are also the causes of suffering in other people's lives too. And that means that whenever we demand that God would step into this world, that he would intervene, that he would end evil, but he has to start with us. That he has to deal with us, whose hearts are tainted with evil just like a wine bottle that's been corked. Just has to be thrown out. The true problem of evil is, how is it that God can end evil and not end us at the same time? That's the true problem. Let me move on this and take you to the second thing this evening, which is get us to think about a companion in suffering. You see, the good news of Christianity is that God has not remained distant and unfeeling from our pain. Rather, God has pursued us in love, that he has come into this world to do something about the problem in the person of his son, Jesus Christ. Jesus has walked in our shoes, literally, for miles and miles and miles. He's worn our skin. He has tasted our pain. He has drunk the bitter cup of suffering that we all have drunk from. Today, he's crowned in heaven and he is scarred by the wounds that we inflicted upon him. Briefly this evening, I want to tell you the true story of the day whenever Jesus came to a house that was in the midst of mourning. You'll find this story in John's Gospel in chapter 11. Jesus' friend Lazarus had died 4 days previously, and Jesus has come to this family of his friends to comfort them and care for them in the midst of their grief. And as Jesus walks into town that day, one of Lazarus' sisters, her name was Martha, ran up to him. And Martha is gripped in the vice of disappointment with Jesus. She had hoped that Jesus would come a week before and that he would heal her brother in the midst of his sickness. But Jesus delayed. And so Martha, she runs up to Jesus and she says to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Jesus, in response, tells her, "Your brother will rise again." To which Martha agrees. She says, "I know that he will rise again on the last day." I wonder if in Martha's voice there was a tinge of frustration. "I know he will rise in the resurrection on the last day." Because sometimes whenever we're suffering, the last thing we want is someone to come along and just give us some pious platitudes. We don't want people to dismiss the depth and the reality of our pain and suffering in the present with just some sort of pie in the sky when you die platitude. It just doesn't help us in the moment, no matter how true it might be. I wonder if she's frustrated. But Jesus isn't just fobbing her off with some platitude. You see, the Old Testament is filled with teaching about the last day. It tells us that history is not a cycle just going endlessly nowhere. No, history is going somewhere. It is building to a climax on the last day when the dead will be raised, when the world will be healed. And Martha is an Orthodox Jew. She says, "I believe that history is going somewhere. I believe that on the last day my brother will be raised and the world will be healed." But Jesus then shocks dear Martha. He tells her that this day she's going to get a glimpse of that last day. Jesus tells her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet he shall live." Jesus is making an absolutely astounding claim that the power of the future age, the power of the last day, is his power. And that because he is the Son of God, he was the creator and giver of life on the first day, he's the one who will raise and give new life on the last day, and he's also going to do it this day in Martha's family. And Jesus doesn't just talk the talk. Jesus then asks to be taken to Lazarus's tomb. Perhaps they're a bit confused about what he has just said. They probably just expected that Jesus wants to pay his respects to his dead friend. But Jesus has something far greater in mind. So they arrive at the hillside. It's just a hill filled with tombs, filled with dead bodies. The Bible then at that point tells us two words. Jesus wept. It's the shortest statement recorded in the entire Bible. Jesus wept. At Sunday school, I always wished that this would be our memory verse for the week. It would be easy. Jesus wept. And these two words can be an incredible comfort to us at the times in our lives whenever we are asking, "Does God really care? Where is God in the midst of all my hurt, all my pain, all my brokenness, all my disappointment? Does he care?" Jesus wept. The Christian journalist Philip Yancey has written, "Although I cannot learn from Jesus why a particular bad thing occurs, I can learn how God feels about it. Jesus gives God a face, and that face is streaked with tears. Anyone who wonders how God feels about suffering on this groaning planet need only look at that face. And what you would see is that Jesus wept." And Jesus' tears aren't just tears of grief, they are also tears of anger. We're told twice that Jesus was deeply moved, that he was greatly troubled. In essence, Jesus is angry. He is indignant at the tragedy of death. It's not just tragedy, it's an enemy. It shouldn't be this way, Jesus knows. Death and evil, it is an unwanted invader into God's good world. It afflicts and it hurts God's precious people, and Jesus is angry about it. It's not okay. One theologian has said that when I see the death of a child, I do not see the face of God, but the face of his enemy instead. That's what Jesus saw at that tombside. His enemy that he has come to destroy and to vanquish. Jesus has come to end the tyranny of death and to liberate his people from its clutches. He's come to return things to the way they were always meant to be. He's about to prove that he really is the resurrection and the life. And so Jesus asks the family, open the tomb, roll back the stone that's blocking the entrance. The family object, it's the Middle East, it's hot. 4 days in a tomb, hot, dead body, not good combination. And yet Jesus says, open up the tomb. And then into the darkness, Jesus speaks. With a loud voice, he says, Lazarus, come out. An old preacher once commented that he had to say Lazarus, because if he hadn't, the entire hillside at that moment would have just been emptied of people. And out of the dark door walked the dead man, very much alive. That day, Jesus proved that he was the resurrection and the life. The story continues, however, because Jesus' action in raising Lazarus from the dead near to Jerusalem on this particular day, it set off a wildfire. It sealed his fate in the eyes of the religious leaders of Israel. We're told that so from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. He was such a threat to them after this incredible display of his power that they had to get rid of him and silence him, whatever the cost, whatever it took. That's so important to see, that Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead has sealed Jesus' fate that he's going to have to die. And that is no accident, because Jesus did not just come to sympathize with us and weep with us in the midst of our pain and suffering, but Jesus came into this world to save us from it. And yet the way that he would save us from suffering and evil, it's surprising. Jesus has to become a victim of evil in order to vanquish evil. Jesus is going to, in a few days' time after that, become the victim of a miscarriage of justice. He is going to be murdered on a cruel wooden cross. And yet, that horrendous act of evil, that horrific day of suffering, was at the very center of all of God's plan for time and eternity to end evil and to save people like you and I whose hearts are tainted with evil. Because Jesus is like the hero in many of our favorite stories, the one who has sacrificed his life in order to save others. As Jesus dies on the cross, he absorbs, if you like, our sin and our guilt and our shame. He takes it upon himself. And he then willingly absorbs the wrath and the judgment of God against evil and sin. And then he brings it down to death and the grave to make an end to it. And in doing that, Jesus, through his death on the cross, has made it possible for us to be reconciled with a good, moral God. But don't miss the key thing, that Jesus has suffered. We have a God who knows what it is to suffer. We have a companion in our sufferings. That's the second thing. And then thirdly, and very briefly, there is a hope beyond suffering. Because the death of Jesus is not the end of the story. Evil and injustice does not have the last word over his life. The good news of Christianity tells us an incredible moment in history that has changed everything. The fact is that Jesus not just died on Friday, but on Easter Sunday morning, he rose again from the dead. He rose again as our champion. His resurrection from the dead assures us that there is a day coming when good will triumph over evil, finally. When death will die. When all will be made well, when our tears will cease, our pain will be healed. You may not know it, but J.R.R. Tolkien, the author of The Lord of the Rings, was a Christian. And the Christian worldview very much is in the background of all of his works. And in his third volume of Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Return of the King, there's this wonderful little phrase that talks about how one day everything sad is going to come untrue. It's just after they've thrown the ring into the fires of the mountain. Evil has just been defeated. And now the characters are thinking to themselves that this is the day whenever evil is going to, all that is sad is going to come untrue. Aragorn is going to be crowned king. When the king has returned to Minas Tirith, he is going to be crowned king. And we're told that the way that the king will be identified is that he will have healing hands. And he heals one of the characters who's been wounded mortally in battle. So when the king returns, when he is crowned, he has healing hands. And he will make everything sad untrue. And that is very much the story of Christianity. Right now, we are continuing to be in the middle of the story. We've not reached the end, the last day, just yet. We continue to hurt. We continue to feel pain and sadness and grief and misery in so many ways. But when the king returns, he returns with healing hands. And he is going to make everything sad untrue. Just as Jesus was raised bodily from the dead, so that is a pattern for what will happen to your body if you're trusting in Jesus, and what will indeed happen to all of this world, which is aching and groaning and dying, that it too will be raised into a new glorious creation. Of that last day, God has promised that I will wipe every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. If you remember nothing else from this evening, I want you to know that our search for healing goes beyond this world, goes beyond the horizon of this world, and it ends in the healing hands of Jesus. Just as we finish up, a few years ago, I was listening to the radio when I was out driving, and I heard the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, being interviewed. He told the story of how his family in 1983 was involved in a car crash. He and his wife had a little daughter at the time. She was 7 months old. Her name was Joanna. Little Joanna died from her injuries sustained in the crash caused by this drunk driver that hit their car. And reflecting back on that time of pain and agony in their life, Justin said this: Christian faith doesn't hide us from the cruelties of life. Jesus himself faced every aspect of the cruelty of life that is possible. It's just in it. He is there in the middle of the mess with us. What I want you to know tonight is that as you hurt, as you search for healing, I want to point you to where you can find it. I want you to know that whatever you have been through in the past, whatever lies ahead of you in the mists of the future, please don't face those things alone. Come to Jesus, find refuge in him. And one day you will find your healing in his hands. If you want to read some more about Jesus, about his wonderful promises, we have these little booklets at the back. There are copies of the Gospel of John in which you'll find the story I told you this evening of Jesus and Lazarus. We'd love you to take one away for free and read more and ask more about Jesus. Well, thanks for listening to me. Time for some questions, Alec.
So, yeah, we've got some questions come through. First one, why does God allow people to die so young when he has the power to stop it?
Yes, good question. One of the challenges for us as human beings is recognizing that we're not God, and that we don't know and understand everything. I was reading a book last night by a minister called Paul Mallard, whose family have been through tremendous pain and suffering through the last 25 years. His wife has a deteriorating neurological condition. She's in a wheelchair now, has been for many years. And he is, if you ever see this man out and about, he speaks at conferences around about the country, you should just see how he cares for his wife. It's incredible. And he used this illustration. He said, in my study at home, I have a goldfish bowl with a goldfish in it. And every morning I go and I talk to my goldfish. And then I discovered that someone told me that a goldfish only has about 3 minutes of memory. So I think I'm building up this relationship that this fish loves me. It knows that I care for it all the time. But actually, every time I go and talk to my goldfish, it's like a first-time encounter for it. He then pushes back and says, actually, I've now discovered that fish have slightly longer memories than 3 minutes, but still, it's not great. And then he says, there's an incredible difference between the mind of a goldfish in its little bowl and my mind. And how much more, then, is there a difference between my mind and the mind of God? And I have a lot of questions, Paul says. I have a lot of questions about the things that we've gone through. Why did we lose a little child? Why has my wife been through so much pain and suffering in her life? Why this? Why that? But I have to accept that I'm just like a little goldfish in a goldfish bowl in comparison to the mind of God. And one day I trust that all my questions will be answered. There's mystery about why do little ones, young ones, good people die. It just doesn't seem to make sense. I, I plead to you is to have humility and to allow God to be God. And the one thing that, even though he doesn't answer that particular question specifically in a way that is clear, what he has given us is he's come in a very real, very tangible way and has shown us what he thinks of that misery and that pain and that death. Look at Jesus in the midst of all your questions. Look at what he has come to do for you. Look at how he has felt your pain, how he has cared with people who have lost ones whom they love. See the face of God and his heart. And when you do, you'll see, even though I don't have the answers just yet to some of those questions, I know that he is good and I can trust him with this. I'm just going to let him hold this until I'm ready to receive an answer. That would be my plea to you, that one, to remember that just because it doesn't make sense to us, that does not mean that in the mind of God there is not something more going on.
Yes, another one. Why is it so hard to break through suffering and hurting for circumstances that have happened in the past? It causes more hurt now than when it did at the time and affects having a close relationship with God.
Give me the first bit again, Alec.
Why is it so hard to break through suffering and hurting for circumstances that happened in the past?
I know what you mean. I think because the things that we have suffered in the past, they go deep, don't they, into our hearts. They like if you get a physical wound, it leaves a mark. I have a very small, it's not anything to write home about. I have a scar on my hand from my brother, a middle brother who did something to me when I was about 10 years old, and it still marks me. And if that's physically true, that we carry around the marks of our wounds, our war wounds, we like to call them sometimes as guys, how much more is it true psychologically and emotionally that when we've been through trauma and hardship, that there would be almost a psychological and emotional scar that we carry around with us, that we find hard. The problem is, though, whenever a scar doesn't begin to heal, but rather it begins to fester and it begins to get worse and get infected. I think that's why Jesus talks a lot about forgiveness. He tells us that it is important that we would love our enemies and that we would forgive those who wrong us. That can be a very hard thing to do. And yet Jesus tells us that not to be harsh and cruel to us, but because he knows that the people who get most hurt by unresolved, unforgiven hurts is you. Because you just keep on turning it over and over in your mind and in your heart. You just keep on reliving it. And even though that thing happened a long time ago, it's like you just go through it again and again and again. And forgiveness involves saying, I'm going to set that down. I can't change what has happened, but I can resolve that that thing is not going to define the rest of my life. I'm going to ask for God's help to be able to let that person out of my little personal courtroom where every day I just, as the prosecutor, go, how could you do this? How dare you do this? Da, 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 and just recount all the evidence, get this person, relive the incident, to actually say, I'm going to let that person out of my personal courtroom. I'm going to entrust them into the hands of God, who one day will make all things right, will make all wrongs right. I'm going to let him sort those things out. And while I can't make sense of all that stuff that's gone on, I'm going to ask for God's help to put it down, to no longer torture myself with it, and ask for his help to live now and experience his healing emotionally and psychologically in my life, and trust him that one day he will make that right. So why is it so hard? Because it goes deep, and so deep that only God can help you, give you the strength and the power to set it down and move on and entrust it into his care for ultimate justice.
So we've got a few along a similar theme here. What can we do about suffering if we're right in the middle of it at the moment? If we're going through the same situations again and again, each time it feels like we're getting pushed away further from God. What can we do about suffering? And is it possible to gain full healing from it?
What can we do in the midst of our sufferings? If you're here and you're a Christian, I would encourage you to turn to the Psalms. It's amazing that God has given us a book, the Bible, which is filled with all the different things that we will need for our journey through this world. And the Psalms is a book of prayers and songs and meditations and, if you like, complaints, in which God's people in the past share with us from their experiences along life's journey, the ups and the downs, and where they give us words to think about and to pray to God and to say to God. And you'll find that almost half of the Psalms are unhappy songs. Today in our song culture in churches, we sing largely happy songs. It's interesting to me that in God's book, in God's only hymn book, almost half of them are sad songs, because life is tough. Life is hard. Life is often difficult. And God has given us words to use in those hard, difficult, dark times. And so I would encourage you to get to know the Psalms, to use the Psalms. God is inviting you to, he is saying to you, in the midst of your pain, don't hold it to yourself. Don't keep it all locked up to yourself. You can't cope with it. I don't want you to cope with it on your own. You don't know what to say? I've given you the words to say. I've given you permission, in fact, to have a falling out with me, to shout at me, to tell me that it seems that I have done you in terrible wrong. To ask questions that almost sound like they're blasphemous and wrong. How can a good God allow such terrible things to happen? That's the question we're thinking about tonight, but that question's in the Bible. Yancey often says this in his books, that the questions that atheists and skeptics raise about suffering, those very same questions are in the Bible, in the lips of people who have known God. It's okay to ask God the hard questions. And so in the midst of your present pain, let me plead with you, please, don't hold it to yourself. Please turn to God and use the Psalms to show you the way and to give you the words and to give you the permission you need to be honest and real with God about what you're really feeling. He's big enough to take whatever you've got to say. Also, community is important. God has given you a church family to walk with you and to encourage you and to look after you. One day, actually, God will use the pain and suffering that you're going through just now, and he will use it in somebody else's life who is hurting. He will use you and your experiences and your proving that God's grace is real and it helps. He will use that to pour blessing and help into someone else's life who is hurting. So be a part of community. Don't get isolated. Don't get stuck all on your own. Use the Psalms to turn to God and be a part of your church family. The second question was about is full healing possible? Yes, I guess it's all a question of timing. Yes is the easy answer. Timing is the hard question, because it can be God's will for there to be miraculous, instantaneous healing of physical, emotional, psychological pain and hurting in our lives. That is certainly possible. It's not wrong to pray that. But very often, that healing will come later, in its fullest possible sense. It's interesting to me that Lazarus, in the passage that Alec read to us earlier, I started into the story a little bit late, but news comes to Jesus that Lazarus is sick a few days before he dies, and Jesus deliberately delays coming to see Lazarus and to heal him. And Jesus actually waits until he gets word that Jesus has already died before he sets out to the house. Seems rather callous thing to do. But what is Jesus teaching us there? He says it's so that God's glory might be revealed. Because sometimes God answers to our pleas for healing is no. I have something else in mind, something more glorious. Someday I'm not just going to patch things up. Someday I'm going to let death have its full effect so that I might resurrect you into glory in a new life. So full, complete healing is something that all of us are waiting for on the last day. Until then, we can experience improvement, we can experience help, but we have no promises that right now God will absolutely heal us from all our problems. It's as someone has said, healing is something that God can give, but it's not something that we can claim right now. But it is something that one day we can look forward to with absolute certainty, because that is just as Jesus has risen again from the dead. So we will be raised into perfect, glorious new life, in a perfect, glorious new cosmos, to be enjoyed forever and ever and ever. That's the future. That's for sure. because of what happened in the past. Just right now, we have to walk by faith and trust the Lord as we pray and as he answers. Sometimes yes, sometimes no, and sometimes not yet.
Got time for a few more, so?
Yeah, why not?
So, one more just going back to children and people dying so young. If a child dies before an age of understanding, does it still go to heaven?
Yes,
good
following
question. Up from that, if it does, would it then not be better for us all to die before we reach that age of understanding?
Good question. Right, thanks for the second part of that question especially. Right. Honestly, the theologians disagree on this one. Kind of question you hope you don't get asked in public, because then you don't have to finally... You can sit in the fence up until a moment like this, and then you've got to nail your colours to the mast. I'll follow up this one. In our family, I thought about this one a lot. Remember when Kirsty told me that she was pregnant, I was reading a book that night. It was a Sunday night. I was reading a book. I could still take you to the very sentence on the page when she came in and told me, with a giant grin on her face, forever marked out that particular book, that particular sentence. And then... oh, she'll not be happy, I tell you. But then she started to cry because she was afraid. What if this little one... She's a doctor. She knows. She was doing at that time pediatrics and stuff. She saw a lot of miscarriages. I think 1 in 10 pregnancies in this country end in miscarriage. What if something goes wrong? We prayed that night together. And just resolve that we would trust the Lord, whatever happened. But I began to think about this question a bit, and there is nothing completely clear in Scripture. We have no clear promises, but we have little glimpses that seem to suggest that God in his kindness can choose to save an infant that... dies before it has an ability to understand its problem, its sinfulness, to understand who Jesus is, what he's come to do to save that child. God in his grace could choose to save that child. There is a passage in the book of 2 Samuel, in fact. King David has had a child through an adulterous liaison with a woman. It's a terrible scandal. It marks the turning point in the nation's life. It's a disaster, his life, from that point onwards. And his family is riven apart through what happens next. And the little child conceived in this adulterous liaison dies just shortly after it's born. And David says these words. He says, after he's been told the child has died, that the child will not come back to him, to David, but one day he, David, will go to that child. And that's just a little hint that David seems to have this confidence that God is the kind of God who, in his grace and goodness and mercy, even to a child conceived through sin and adultery, that God in his grace and his mercy would have mercy on that little child. And that one day David will be united with his son. I know various people who have said that we have 3 children on earth and we have 2 in heaven. 3 children on earth and 2 in heaven. I know a lady who's had 2 miscarriages now. She talks about her boy and her girl in heaven, and she's got her 3 kids on the earth. She gets that from that passage in David. I would hope that was the case, but the scriptures don't give us more than that to go on. And I don't want to answer the second question. I don't, off the cuff. I'll have a think and I'll reply to you.
Cool. So we'll have probably one more question. If your question hasn't been answered, sorry I haven't got around to it with enough time, but please don't go away without it being answered. Please come and speak to Dave afterwards, because it'd be really good to get some of these things discussed. So finally, what would Jesus say to somebody who is struggling with suicidal thoughts and just wants to be with him in heaven and end the sufferings of this life?
Yeah, I have sat with people who have been in that place where that seemed to make sense to them, and I'm really sorry that there are things in your life that have driven you to a place like that, where you would feel that that is the only recourse you have. Someone in my own family has been thinking and saying such things recently, and that's been hard to talk with him and to seek to remind him that, no, there is hope. That you do not need to take things into your own hands like that. That there is still hope for you. That the very fact that you are still here shows that God has plans and purposes for your life that are worth living here and now. I would say to you that there are people who love you and people that you need to talk to. And you don't need to be ashamed. You don't need to fear how they will react, that they love you. Don't keep these things to yourself. Reach out to them. Allow them to walk with you and look after you at this time. Come and speak to me. Come to speak to Wayne. Come speak to Dave if you want to. We've journeyed that road with some people before as well. But we plead with you to see that there is hope. There is hope.
Thank you, Dave. So yeah, we know that we live in a broken and messed up world, a world where there's pain and there's suffering.